The title of today's discussion is why do we do what we do? Now, I could say, why do I do what I do? Or I could say, why do you do what you do? Even though it seems to be the same. Why do we do what we do? Why do I do what I do? Why do you do what you do? After all, it's a generic question. It's a question which asks, why do we act the way we act? But actually, there's a subtle and significant difference between the three. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I feel very strongly the difference. If I think of this discussion as why do we do what we do? When I think of we in this case, okay, I understand this is not a very, shall we say, strictly logical, philosophical understanding. I understand that. This is more of a feeling discussion. When I think of the we, why do we do what we do? The discussion becomes more of a vision. Discussion of a vision, the vision we have, our collective consciousness, which is moving in a very specific direction. If you think about it right now, our collective consciousness in this world is moving in a direction which is producing difficulties, producing increasing difficulties in the world. In other words, it's producing problems in this world. It's producing perhaps catastrophe, disaster, as our self-fulfilling prophecy is manifesting, where we feel that disaster should come. Maybe it's been predicted and we believe it. Maybe others have told it to us and we believe it. So we are, as a mass, creating the situation. We've already discussed this. So why are we doing this? It could be us as a collective consciousness feels that it's the only way to save the world. Maybe us as a collective consciousness feels that things have gone so far, that problems and difficulties are so bad, that there's no other solution than this breakdown. A breakdown, an implosion, a collapse, because it will cause such a radical change that we will stop doing what we're doing. Now, if you think about that logically, it's a little bit strange. We have to create destruction to stop destruction. We feel that things are getting so bad. Now, what does that mean? It means that we think things are moving to destruction. So we feel somehow deep inside that the only way to stop this is to bring about self-inflicted destruction. After all, why would we embrace it? Just because you're afraid of it doesn't mean you would embrace it and make it happen. If we are afraid of something, we can also try to stop it or defend ourselves. Could we consider it a defense to embrace destruction? Does that make sense? Is it a defense to kill yourself? If you're going to defend yourself against fear, is it a defense to kill yourself? Okay, maybe if you're going to be kidnapped by some horrible, evil terrorist who's going to torture you, and it's going to be inconceivable torture, then killing oneself in advance of that might be a defense. If that torture was certain. So maybe one might justify it by thinking that horrible catastrophe, chaos, and cataclysm will come, therefore I should make destruction come very rapidly, or losing everything would come, and war and chaos and terror, I should make it come rapidly. This is very unusual mentality, that destruction is a defense against destruction. Now, some may think that I'm being radical, that I'm exaggerating. But I see this also in individuals' lives, where individuals embrace a destruction to defend themselves against a destruction. Okay, destruction doesn't necessarily have to mean a bomb blows up and it all destroys. It can mean ruination of one's economy, ruinations of one's reputation, ruination of one's family, ruination of one's health. All of this is possible. Now, why do we do this? Let's go back now, take away the we, which is creating a collective reality. Why do you do what you do? And the reason I say you, because I could say, why do I do what I do? But why I do what I do is not relevant to you. I would speak to you specifically about my own way of seeing things, my own psychology, my own emotional state. But unless I got really, 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 really down to the very core, fundamental bottom of the whole thing, and I was able to honestly say it to you, which is unlikely. After all, who are you? Why should I trust you with that very tender, sensitive core of my being, which is experiencing this motivation to act in this physical realm? And since this is a discussion which is supposed to be relevant to a larger group of people, I'll use the subject, why do you do what you do? Because it's easy for me to talk about you. You see, it's easier for me to talk about you. It's easier for me, it's more comfortable for me to analyze you, because I'm safe. Because I'm not the subject of this intellectual or psycho-emotionally based dissection of your existence, like in an autopsy after the murder has taken place. They cut open the body and they look everywhere. Or in a laboratory when they're trying to do research and understand. Or even in a psychological sense when it's not so radical. But I don't think that's actually a very... that's not something to be proud about. It should not be something that gives one pleasure to look at somebody else and say, it's easy for me to talk about you because there's not that much pain there for me. I don't think that's something to be proud about. I think that if I'm going to say something relevant, it has to be, why do I do what I do? Why do I do what I do? If that's really, if the reason I'm speaking about it is really based in a feeling to be of service, not all the time do I feel to be of service. I do not have every minute of every day a desire to be of service. But I have it sometimes. When I'm sitting here before you, or in any place where I might speak, or I might try to advise somebody on how to resolve some situation, or I try to help somebody in some way, I have generally the desire to be of service. I wish to do something which is beneficial for somebody else. I don't need to make that person do what I want them to do. That's not being of service. That is making a demand and an expectation on somebody else. That's not being of service. If I'm going to tell you what is best for you, if I'm going to tell you what I want you to do, even if I'm convinced it's the best thing for you, even if it really is the best thing for you, I'm not actually being of service. If I'm telling, when I say telling, I mean, you should do this, or you must do this. Now, I know this is a very, very subtle distinction here, and there's a reason I'm discussing it, because it's very much related to why we do what we do, in the individual sense, not in the collective sense. Now, let's say I want to be of service, and that is a very big motivation in my life, because I'm talking about me, because honestly speaking, that's the only real discussion I can have that is deeply relevant to this discussion right now. So I really like being of service sometimes. But I have seen through the years, and a lot of years, that telling somebody what's best for them is not the best for them. If I tell you what's best for you, well, one of two things could happen. Well, one of three things, but you could just reject it. But I don't want to talk about that. That's okay if you reject it, but that's not really important to this discussion. Or maybe it is. But you could say, yes, that sounds good, I shall do it. Or you could say, I'll think about it and I'll consider it. Okay, let's get the time lapse out of the way here. The real generic thing I'm talking about is you could either accept what I say as being the best for you, or you could take my advice and consider it. Now, you could also just reject it, but that's not very useful, because if that rejection happens immediately, that's what I meant, You hear it and you reject it. That's not wise. It's very possible that I'm saying something to you which is unusual, something you don't usually think about. Or maybe it's so related to the core of your being that it's agitating your energy so much. It's coming so close to that which you're protecting dearly from any offense that may take place from outside, that you reject it instantly. That's not in your interest to do so. Let's discuss now these two important points, because if you say, instead of rejecting it, you say, let me think about it, what you're really doing is you're saying, let me use this stimulus. It's a stimulus. And there's really nothing wrong with stimulus, because we get it everywhere, all around us, all the time. Sound and sights and smells and tastes and touches. Words that have concepts. Images which make me feel in certain ways. Energies which I'm absorbing. This is all stimulus. And these stimuli could cause me to react, or will cause me to react, in different ways. So I accept what someone says to me. Even if they say, you must do this. You should do this. I expect you to do this. It's the rule. It's the law. Even if it's all true. What you say is, I will consider it. You have that attitude within you. I will consider it. I will hear what is being stated. I will analyze it, absorb it, try to understand what is being stated. Because if I just reject it, if I just reject it or I just accept it, I don't necessarily have a good idea of what it is. If I just reject it, I haven't been close enough to it to get that understanding. If I just accept it, I haven't accepted it because of a specific analysis of something which is good or beneficial or attractive. I just say, oh, good. It's an immediate reaction. That also has its place. Both acceptance and rejection have its place. After all, if something's too hot and it burns you and reject it, push it aside, get it off of you so it doesn't harm you, that's good. If there's an emergency situation and somebody's going to save you and says, come, you just accept it without thinking, that's good. But those are exceptions. That happens rarely. Generally, we are in situations where there is a time, a space where we can consider, a space of consideration. And we say, wisely, let me think about it. Let me consider it. Consider is a much better word. I don't know how it translates, but consider is a much better word than let me think about it. Let me think about it is an idiom. It doesn't necessarily mean I will have thoughts. What it really means is not now, later, I shall make some response. So really what I'm saying is, let me consider it. Let me consider it means there's going to be time, a time lapse, and I reserve the right to use all of it, none of it, or any quantity in between, according to how I feel and what I think is right. That's the mentality of having personal responsibility, personal respect, integrity, that my life is my life. Whatever stimulus is coming to me is something I shall consider. How fast I consider it depends on the situation. But I will consider it. Then on the other side, there is the I accept. The idea I accept. This is quite an interesting idea. In many cases, it's the enemy of I will consider it. I accept. Why? An authority, or not even an authority, someone else is in a position where I feel I must satisfy them or accept, or I should accept what they say in order to induce them to accept me. In other words, I consider that accepting what that person says is important for me somehow or other. You know the obvious example. You're in a spiritual discipline where you think that there is a higher authority who dictates and determines what is best for you. You surrender to that, and whatever they say, whatever it is they give, they are the authority in your life. You follow it, whether you like it or not. That's very similar to like the military or a corporation where one needs the job, one needs the money, so one has to satisfy the boss. Or in the military where you don't think, you just do what you're told. In those situations, by choice or by inscription, by force, you are in a situation where you have to follow. Now, even if you're in a spiritual thing, you joined it, you engaged in it because you had a very powerful motivation to do so. And again, we are right now on the bottom of why did you do what you did? This is the same for me. Why did I do what I did? I came to spiritual organization. I looked around and I said, this is so much better than everything else I got going on in my life. I'm resonating with it. My deepest consciousness is saying, yes, it's spiritual energy. I like that. I'm reaching out to that. I'm embracing it. I'm letting it flow into me. I'm drinking it deep. It's a relief from the situation of whatever it was in my life that just wasn't working. You know from Bhagavad Gita that people may do that because they're in need of money, or, you know, they're looking for knowledge, or they're trying to find relief from pain. Now, naturally, those are the things that go on. I must admit I was more in the looking for knowledge category because I didn't really have any pain in my life. And I didn't care about money. I didn't really have problems that I had to solve. It was just like a question of, what's the use of this whole thing? You know, I'm a 60s guy. The world, I concluded, was simply absorbed in selfishness and materialism. Oh, boy, did I have no clue what was coming today as compared to then. And I saw no way to deal with it other than enter into this spiritual realm, which I assumed would have been the total answer. And so I was in the spiritual honeymoon of it all, and I learned and I imbibed that the way to amplify this feeling, the way to actually attain that state of transcendence far beyond this material realm, is to detach myself from everything material, attach myself to everything spiritual, surrender myself totally and fully and utterly to the lotus feet of a spiritual master, a guru, who will carry me back to Godhead under any and all circumstances if I simply satisfy him and do what he says. Regardless of how I feel, as in a military discipline. And that it's my responsibility to deeply understand that by accepting the scriptures, understanding the scriptures, and understanding every reason on earth and in heaven why this is so. And I did that. Why did I do what I did at any moment in time? And I'm sure this is relevant to all of us, because otherwise we wouldn't be listening to this, even if we were in some movement or not. We all had this desire for spiritualism. Otherwise, you don't listen to me. People who are not interested in spirituality don't listen to me. So, we did it, and we do it, even to this day, whatever it is we do, in spirituality, because we want to connect to God. Our fundamental motivation is we want to connect to God. I mean, after all, if you were to join a spiritual movement because you want to get freed from pain, or you want to get freed from economic problems, or you want to whatever it is in your life, first of all, you don't solve any economic problems, even if you get fed. And you don't get freed from pain. In fact, in many respects, you increase it. Most people leave rapidly when they realize that. Only those who are interested in attaining the goal of knowledge, connection with the divine, with the supreme, would remain. Now, so long as you believe that what you have been told is the way to attain that goal, which is your fundamental reason for being in such an organization, you will continue to believe in that authority and in that literature. So long as you believe this is the way, you will do it. If and when you ever allow yourself to question. You might change your mind. Now, the reason I started off this discussion with the one who says I shall consider it as opposed to the one who says I accept is that in a lot of cases, if not most cases, of those who sustain the capacity to accept over longer periods of time. And remember, this is mainly those who wish to have shelter and they do it because they are convinced this is the way to do it. For example, they have knowledge or they're looking for it. The problem with one who does that acceptance is that part of that acceptance includes a forbidding rule, a restriction. Do not question these fundamental principles. Once you have accepted, to question the guru or the fundamental principles is not only counterproductive, it's destructive of your spiritual goal. So out of fear, one continues and never allows the questioning on the significantly deep level to occur. One may have some few doubts and question these things, and generally the doubts will be related to individuals or an organization or something political in relation to it, because that's safe. It's safe to criticize management. It's safe to criticize individuals. It's not safe to criticize guru. It's not safe to criticize shastra. It's not even safe to criticize, when I say criticize, I mean to analyze in a critical way. To question critically even the delivery of that knowledge from guru or shastra. One has to just accept it. So therefore, that pure acceptance can turn out to be counterproductive. When one is in a situation where deeply inside one knows something's wrong, but has no way to find it out, because that has been blocked. If you just consider it, you have this like this package of a person. And in some portion of that package, there is this doubt. But there's a wall between the doubt and the capacity to resolve it, even if the doubt is shaking very much, because this wall says you cannot go there and understand why it's so. And usually such people become rabid, even to the point of insane critics of individuals or management. It's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault. We blame others. It's just the way it is. Now, one who just simply says, I will consider it at all times, places themselves as the ultimate authority to choose. That person has not only the best chance to attain their goal, and that includes that person has the best chance to connect to God. That person has the best chance to know how to be of service. That person has the best chance to know how to fix something when something's wrong. In other words, how to recognize what's wrong and how to fix what's wrong. Because that person has no restriction like that. That person has no place they cannot go in their own consciousness. That person has no wall within them that says, you cannot enter this, you cannot touch this, you cannot think about this, you cannot contact this. That person is open within to go where they need to go to do what they need to do. To do what? To do what they want to do. After all, even if you just accept, let's say you join the army, or you join a corporation which is restrictive, or you join a religion, there's a reason for doing it. You did it because you thought it was the best thing for you to do at the time you did it. You felt that this was the way in which you're going to solve the problems which were facing you. It was the way to attain success. Whatever that may be, even just to have friends. Sometimes people join groups because they're lonely. But you felt there was a reason to do it. The person who considers, who just says, I'll consider every stimulus, I'll consider every philosophical idea, I'll consider everything I'm told, every advice I'm given, and I will see whether it fits me or not at this moment, started on that path, and don't make a mistake. It's a conscious decision. After all, in a family, when you're a child, you don't have the capacity to make such choices unless you have really aware and elevated parents, evolved parents. And when you're in school, you also don't have that. You are, until you come out of the educative system, you have to fulfill the demands of others, whether you think it's right or wrong. I had professors in my university who I thought were the greatest idiots I have ever seen or heard. Absolute idiots. Saying things which were stupid, illogical, irrational, but they were the professors. If I was to pass in their courses, I had to agree with them. Because if I were to give them a paper which spoke about what I felt, which disagreed with them, they would automatically assume that I did not know what I was talking about, and I was not referring to authoritative sources. It's human nature. And because these men were such idiots, they were convinced that it was so. Okay, I've had professors who were absolutely wonderful people, were practically, I idolized them. I idolized the way they taught, the effort they made, the people that they were, the way they tried to help me. I mean, there were teachers who I was in love with. I had an English teacher, I think it was in 11th grade in high school. His name was Mr. Johnson. He was English. English teacher was English. I loved the man. I thought he was wonderful. No other teacher in my entire educative history inspired me so much to write than this man. And when I wrote, I felt no restriction coming from him. I felt I had, there was nothing I couldn't say. There was nothing I couldn't express. And so I would write from my very heart, from my very soul, from my very being. Okay, as much as I could do it when I'm 15, 16 years old, I understand that. But he would read what I wrote and he would love it. He gave me an A on a poem I wrote, which was so radical, considering the time. He said it was exquisite. And I was like floating in clouds for weeks afterwards. I had it posted in my room somewhere. Exquisite. He just put an A on it and said, exquisite. I was like in heaven. And I've had professors who were total idiots. I've even had professors who've, I'll tell you a little secret. I'm terrible at physics. And I got a D, which is the worst score you could possibly get before failing, in my senior year of high school physics, which convinced me that me and physics were just not going to work together. But my teacher, Mr. Bongerzone, I know that's a very strange name, Bongerzone, if I say it, it sounds strange, but he was a wonderful person. He was actually a wonderful person, even though he gave me this terrible grade. He told me the only reason I passed you is because you spelled your name right on the final exam. He told me, you're not fit for physics. I said, you're right. But I had a real rapport with the man, but I just couldn't understand the subject. So, in the college, you're forced to accept. But after college, you're on your own. You're on your own. All of a sudden, you're in this world on your own. And at one point, you decide whether you are someone who considers or whether you are someone who follows. Are you a follower or are you a considerer? Anyway, at one point, you make a decision either way. At one point you say, I'm going to accept the responsibility for what I am. Even it happened for me before I left college. But at one point you make that decision, I'm going to accept that responsibility. Or you make the decision, I decide, I choose to place myself in the hands of this other person. I remember doing that. But in my case, the only reason I did it was because somehow or another, even though I wasn't even initiated, here I was his servant. I was brought into his personal service. And I developed love for the person. That's why I did what I did. And that love blinded me to the reality of the situation. I know why I did what I did. Now, at that time, I did not have the same awareness. After all, when you're blind, or when you blind yourself, in the sense that I don't want to see that, you have no capacity. You've disconnected yourself from this consideration, being a considering person who will consider. I don't mean considerate, where it means you take care of others and you're nice with others and you consider how they are. I mean a considering, that I'll consider it. I know that's very difficult in Russian, but I'll consider whether this is right or wrong. Now, why do you do what you do? Why do you listen to me? Now, you know I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to solve your problems for you, where you come and you say there's A, B, C, D, and E. What do I do? What I am going to do, what I have been doing, is I give you the tools so that you solve your own problems. I give you the tools. I give you ideas. But even that, you already know these things. I just formulate them in such a way and at such a time that it's just what you need to deal with the situation you're in right now. And the only reason this happens is because there's only one of us and we are connected. And right now what you need is the same as what I need. Why do we do what we do? Many things we do out of habit. Many things we do because it's just what we've always done. A lot of things we do, it's because we think we should. We don't even necessarily question. And some of the things we do because we choose to do it. But what I'm trying to do right now is amplify awareness that we should be very aware of why we do what we do. In other words, if I'm going to undergo something in my day, I'm going to ask myself regularly, why am I doing this? What is it I expect to gain? What is it I want? Now, an answer like money doesn't work. Okay, we need money. Otherwise, nothing goes on. And therefore, we want money because we need it. But how much of it? Do we need $1 billion? Now, if I were to ask you, would you like $1 billion? You would probably, you would probably say yes. Now, what would you do with it? Where would you put it? I write a check for you for $1 billion. Where would you cash it? In other words, where would you go with this check of $1 billion and say, here? Not only that, but how would you explain to your government, your tax agency, where you got $1 billion and why? After all, you can't hide $1 billion. So why do you have this? Where did you get it? And if they accept that, they're going to take at least half or three quarters of it in taxes. So all of a sudden you're down to, let's say, $300 million. Okay, you say, I could live with $300 million. Okay, well, where do you put $300 million? Well, all of a sudden, there's going to be thousands of people surrounding you who have ideas where you can put $300 million. And all of them are going to convince you in very sophisticated ways how wonderful they are and how they're going to work in your interests. Because you really don't know what you're doing, you're going to lose most of your money. It's going to be stolen away in various ways. I remember it happened in my own example. I made the choice that I considered one individual's human life more important than money. And then that individual anyway killed himself. So again, I question, what would I do with hundreds of millions of dollars? Well, the only thing I can think of doing with it is making charity, giving it away to people who need it, or creating something where people can benefit from it. But then that means I would have to do a lot of work. I would have to manage all of that, because if I didn't manage all of that, whoever I put in charge might steal it, might waste it, might do it in ways which are against my interest. So I'd have to be very engaged in it. But then I wouldn't be able to write. I spend most of my days now working on a book. And if I could have time, I would put more into my blog, which is also now on Facebook. I'd like to make more music. I'd like to do things where I, as an individual, directly make an impact on the world around me in some way that's relevant to me as an individual. If somebody gave me tons of money like that, I would be restricted in that way. So then I look back and say, what do I want? Well, really what I want is to do those good things, which is actually more or less what I'm doing now. Without the, let's say, backing of some personality who's going to finance it all, but that would be helpful. But I'm already doing what I want to do. And I don't really feel I should or must or have to or even want to do anything else. I would like to do it with others too. Of course, I'm a people person. That's a fact. No doubt about it. So, if I consider like this, I no longer feel certain things as a motivating factor. Because I've analyzed, gone all the way to the end of what would it be if I got lots of that thing. I realize it's not in and of itself what I want. It's what I could do with it. But then I would be forced to do so many things. So then I conclude, money is good, but lots of it, maybe not so good. Just enough. But then again, I have a little note here on my board here. It says, I get just what I need when I need it. So why do I do what I do? Ultimately, it's because I feel a connection to the universe. I feel a connection to my deities. I feel a connection to the divine energy. And in that connection, there's that energy of oneness between us, where my energy and the energy of the divine is sharing, where it's a flow between, where we have this consciousness. And in that, I want to act. Not just as me alone, but me as that flowing conduit through which the energy of the divine will manifest in its perfect way in communion with me and my energy. And what's so great about the divine is that God has no need to enforce on me the way I should be. God has no need to turn me into the clone of God. In other words, the Supreme, the Divine, Allah, Jehovah, Yahweh. I say, Radha Krishna, okay, I'm fine with that. Whatever, the divine being is so situated in self. The divine being does not need me to be in any way for the sake of the divine being. The divine being sees me as I am, accepts me as I am, fully, all the way down to my darkest side, from my lightest being down to my darkest corner. That divine being accepts all of me and knows how my energy resonates, and is not only encouraging me to act as I am in communion, in tandem with the divine, but embraces that. Because it's the perfection of how my energy can work. The divine takes pleasure in me being totally me, deciding what I want, knowing what I want, without taking instruction from others about what I want, but actually feeling what I want deep within my essence. And the divine takes pleasure in working with me in that way. And it's no longer work, it's a play, it's a dance, where the divine and I dance in perfect union, communion, in tandem, a dance of energy, a dance of essence, where both of us amplify in our particular way, where the divine, who's infinite, no doubt, comes together with my particular package of unique energy that is part of the divine total being, and embraces that uniqueness that cannot be found anywhere else in existence. I am the only place where it's found. Think about that. The divine can only find that essence in me. Okay, in each of us. But this unique way in me. The divine, therefore, reaches out to me to embrace me as I am, not as someone else wants me to be, because certainly it's not the divine who wants me to be that way. It's totally counterproductive for the divine to want me to be anyway. The divine just wants me to be what I am, because that's where the divine finds the uniqueness of that divine existence and embraces that in a dance of love. Therefore, ultimately, in spirituality, to surrender oneself in a way where one just is the way someone tells you to be is not only counterproductive for ourselves, it's counterproductive for the divine. Can you imagine this? That person who stands between you and God, who you are completely convinced in certain circumstances that this is the way to God, this person will bring me to God, is an obstacle or can be an obstacle unless there is total, complete, 100% transparency. In other words, the person is simply the rails upon which your train will roll. That person is simply a pavement, the asphalt upon which your car will move forward towards the divine. Does that person exist? Did that person ever exist? If that person was Lord Chaitanya, yes, I would say that person exists. If that person is themselves divine, and the whole point of the divinity is to bring you in connection with them directly, yes, it is so. Otherwise, one has to be very careful. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, that there's that 1,000% purity and transparency. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. But what I am saying is consider it all the time. Consider it. And understand what it is, why we do what we do. Because if the ultimate reason for doing what we do, or what you do, or what I do, is to make that connection, to once again feel that intimacy where the supreme, the divine, is in union again, in tandem again, with that unique piece of themselves that stands as a living entity on its own, to reciprocate that love, to reciprocate emotions, to reciprocate words and thoughts, to reciprocate the exchange of energy from that place where the divine has no access unless we willingly give it. If that is your goal, then consider what you do all the time. Consider why you do what you do, and consider what it is you think you're going to get from it. Use the same methodology I use to analyze money. What if I got all that money? What would I do? And what do I really want? Use that kind of methodology. You say, what if? What if I was the perfect servant? And what if I was the perfect follower? What if I was the perfect whatever? And then that would mean this or that. Or would it? Or what would it mean? I can't answer the question for you. I can't answer how you would manifest that. In what way you would manifest it? Within what organization, if any? I can't answer any of these questions for you. All I can say is, if you really want to connect with the Supreme, with the Divine, then consider it all the time. Because there is nothing else better. Nothing else more important to you. To me, I know for sure. I would imagine for you. So consider it. Be a considering person. One who makes a space between receiving a stimulus and making a response. If you want, consider it. I mean, philosophically, especially if you're being told what to do, you may want to have an immediate response, like, but even if you're going to eat food, instead of just eating something and say, wow, this is great, because while you're saying, wow, this is great, you don't taste anymore. For example, if you're going to eat something fantastic, and it is great, you just savor it, close your eyes, taste it. Get into that taste, get into that flavor, and just embrace it. In awe of the experience. Anyway, you get the point.